Alexander, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening. I'd like to thank the Centre for Cities for inviting me. I think no organisation has done more to promote the municipal gospel, as we used to say, as much further over the last decade as yourselves. And there's certainly no better place, I think, to understand it in a socialist context than this museum in this great city. Nick Mansfield and now Katie Ashton, the People's History Museum, I think it's brilliantly reimagined the story of Manchester and the place of popular politics and the culture of popular politics within the city. From Chartism to the cooperatives, Methodism to Marxism, it really houses the political pantheon of the Labour movement. I even remember working in the archives coming across a particularly auspicious note from Peter Mandelson when he was Director of Communications to the National Executive Committee. But this evening I want to talk about Manchester's other great contribution, which is of course the modern city, and why we in the Labour Party, rather than being fearful or anxious about the return of the city to political prominence, should be very, very excited by it. In Manchester, Liverpool, and across industrial Britain, the Labour movement and progressive politics came into being to symbolise the last urban century. And as we stand on the precipice of a new industrial revolution, the power of the city waxes once again. Whilst national governments groan under the weight of economic stagnation and institutional collapse, dynamic, open, culturally confident cities are now pulling further and further ahead. As we look across a continent governed by the centre-right and in part threatened by outright fascism, hope for those of us on the centre-left is not often in plentiful supply. Yet what is so fascinating, I think, is that the leading cities of this emergent economic settlement, Hamburg, Berlin, Copenhagen, Manchester, Newcastle, Liverpool, also play host to some of Europe's most successful progressive politicians. And so my message tonight is this: the Labour Party must champion the political devolution and economic democracy that these so-called Borgen cities represent. Just as importantly, my message is that a radical decentralisation of power is also essential for our historic mission of reducing inequality. That building a less divided Britain relies on a public culture that can empower civic activism and unleash local pride. And that evidence clearly shows how devolved government is more responsive, accountable, trusted, knowledgeable, and innovative than Westminster when it comes to making difficult decisions in the community interest. Giving away power helps us reduce inequality in a material sense and start to heal the ties of social obligation that inequality has begun to fray. Now this will not be without, I think, its challenges. For the Labour Party, it requires nothing less than a philosophical deep clean, a rejection of a dominant centralist orthodoxy, and a rediscovery of our municipal socialist roots. But if we draw upon the experiences of these vibrant Borgen cities, embrace the possibilities they afford, then I think there's absolutely no reason why we should not look forward to an urban century ripe with progressive potential. However, it's not just the onrushing future which should be our guide. We should also, in these environments, mine the riches of our past. Because I would also argue that the socialist ethic has never been fully nurtured by a remote and commanding state. That actually Labour's long march through the institutions began at an urban level during the 19th century. It was there, in the municipal gospel, the civic gospel of Joseph Chamberlain in Birmingham. It was there in the community collectivism of the Glasgow Stools, who transformed Clydeside into a test case for municipal socialism, taking control of gas, water, markets, bars, washhouses, slaughterhouses, parks, botanic gardens, art galleries, museums, libraries and tramways as they worked in the interests of the common good. They also crucially took control of Glasgow's golf courses, and I was delighted to see in Sheffield this municipal socialist spirit reproducing itself in the master's champion, Danny Willits. He learnt his craft on the Sheffield golf courses before heading to Jacksonville. But most of all, I think it was here, in Manchester, in the voluntary associations, mechanical institutes, labour exchanges, friendly societies, and nascent trade unions of Manchester. The most marvellous thing in modern history is the influence which institutions, such as Athenaeums and Mechanics Institutes, have exercised over the community. The Congregationalist historian Richard Hall told a Manchester crowd in 1847. Each man stimulates his fellow, and the result is a greater intelligence. The shop, the factory, or the marketplace, the local association, the newsroom, or the religious meeting, all facilitate this invigorating contact of mind with mind. In short, Vaughan saw the industrial city as the apotheosis of human progress. And as the biggest and boldest, it was Manchester that best represented the independence, self-reliance, and condition of equality of the age. Friedrich Engels, that other great Manchester man, was absolutely horrified by this political evolution. He had come to Manchester in 1842 specifically to catch sight of class war and the proletarian revolution. He then wrote in the 1850s, very disappointed, "The English proletariat is actually becoming more and more bourgeois, so that the ultimate aim of this most bourgeois of all nations would appear to be the possession, alongside the bourgeoisie, of a bourgeois aristocracy and a bourgeois proletariat." The growth of trade unions and political parties was not what he had in mind. Yet what so disgusted Engels can serve, I think, as an important lesson for the future of socialism, the Labour Party, and the country itself. Because what those high-minded Victorian ideals helped to create was a public realm predisposed towards social justice, civic activism, and community service. A public realm which, when democratised later in the century, gave birth to the pragmatic municipalism that armed the early Labour Party with its distinctive practical character, and which in turn helped lay the ethical and political foundations for 1945 and the golden age of social democracy. This is a journey we must begin again. And once again, it is the dynamism of Manchester that shows Labour the way. Because we need to be blunt, the truth is the Labour Party, driven by Fabianism and misguided clause for statism, played a full and active role in the march towards Whitehall centralism. Nigel Bevan set out the challenge best when he recounted his formative political years. "Very important man, that's Councillor Jackson," Bevan's father had said to him. "What's the council?" he asked. "Very important place indeed, and they are very powerful men," his father replied. "When I get older," I said to myself, "the place to get to is the council." So I worked very hard, and in association with my fellows, when I was about 20 years of age, I got on the council. I discovered when I got there that power had been there, but it had just gone. So I made some inquiries, being an earnest student of social affairs, and I learned that the power had slipped down to the county council. That was where it was and where it had gone to. So I worked very hard again, and I got there, and it had gone from there too. And where it had gone, of course, was Westminster. And what Bevan described was the steady, slow, but unmistakable emasculation of civic autonomy and local government during the 20th century. It began with early 1900s demands for national efficiency in the face of German competition, which left little room for municipal autonomy. The emergent vogue was for state uniformity rather than civic pride, with liberal legislation in 1906 and 1911 consciously carving out local authority provision. A sign of the times was revealed in 1907 when Winston Churchill indignantly rejected a cabinet position at the local government board. "I refuse to be shut up in a soup kitchen with Mrs. Sidney Webb," was his response. But for Labour at least, the statist impulse was counterbalanced by the Labourist stakeholder trade unionism of Ernie Bevan and municipal stalwarts like Herbert Morrison and the London County Council. Indeed, the interwar years saw something of an Indian summer for municipal socialism. During those decades, whole spheres of public life were owned and managed locally, but are now seen as entirely the province of national government or the private sector. No wonder Beatrice was often heard complaining about the characteristic English preference for local over central administration, and she didn't mean it admiring. However, somewhere, not long after the 45 victory, both the Labour Party in the country began to lose its balance between central and local. Maybe it was the growing dominance of Keynesian central planning, maybe it was Bevan's genius in creating a national health service which so perfectly embodied the common good. Either way, ever since, we have too often succumbed to behaving like the party of the man in white who knows best, of hospital bedpans crashing in trigger and echoing through Westminster's corridors of power. And this heritage, I think, cost us dear at the general election. In shadow cabinet, we often used to talk about how handing back power was essential for tackling the great challenges of our time, from mitigating London's economic dominance to raising productivity and reinvigorating local democracy. And in the work Henry Benn did on the devolution of transport powers, the work programme, and the proper integration of public services, you can still see the fruits of that discussion. But despite this, despite Labour leading the way on devolution for much of the last Parliament, when George Osborne announced the first Manchester deal, our centralist instincts returned, and we allowed the Tories to capture the spirit of the moment. As a result, we missed a golden opportunity to show how we could deliver, in a time of tight public finances, the three promises of the Labour Party: to reduce economic unfairness, to strengthen our communities, to revitalise our national democracy. In short, I think we lacked, in the deadening language of public management, a theory of change. And my message in Manchester this evening is that the time for equivocation is over. We must go further and faster than the Conservative Party on devolution and embrace a new radical localism that puts power back in the hands of our community and restores a sense of civic pride. After all, the needs of Stoke-on-Trent, which I represent, are very different to the needs of Stoke-Newington. And the fight for a better world begins in your own backyard. You dig where you stand. However, I also believe local communities and local politicians will understand those different needs far better than civil servants in London. The evidence for this is compelling. According to the OECD, a more decentralised approach to government correlates with stronger growth, more social investment, better educational outcomes, higher well-being, and less regional inequality. And more than that, the growth it produces is much more inclusive, with a significantly larger proportion of money staying within the community. However, the real reason I support Labour is because I believe in people. Look around the world, everywhere but everywhere, centralised authority is in crisis. It does not speak to what people want in a fast-moving, hyper-connected, pluralistic world. People want a say. People want a stake, people want to participate, people want power. And as Benjamin Barber has lucidly argued in his compelling work, If Mayors Rule the World, Dysfunctional Nations, Rising Cities, pragmatic metropolitan leaders are proving more effective, popular, innovative as political leaders compared to national leaders all around the world. Therefore today, the first step in any radical decentralisation of power must be to take advantage of the new devolution settlement on offer. And this requires us in the Labour Party to reshape, but not reject, the current Tory programme. Now, do not mistake me, I think there is something almost Tammany Hall in the secretive, haphazard, controlling approach the government has taken towards negotiating these city deals. And I remain frustrated that such little thought has been given to devolution beyond our larger cities. Because I do not see why, if the government believes devolution is a driver of economic resilience A new civic settlement should be denied to places like Stoke-on-Trent, or Barnstable, or Southend. In fact, I would go further. It is these cities and towns, really at the sharper end of globalisation's unequal effects, that mostly prosperity and civic pride we trust devolution to deliver. Then there is the almost contemptuous attitude towards the ability of Liberal government from too many Conservative ministers. I mean, what could be more status than compelling local authorities and charitable housing associations to sell off their affordable housing stock? What could be more authoritarian than banning parents from becoming school governors whilst also mandating central control through forced academisation? However, if you want statistics which I think belie this government's one nation credentials, then look no further than its partisan approach to local government finance. The average cut per household in a Labour area would be more than £330 per household in this parliament. By contrast, in Conservative areas, it's just £68 per household. Nevertheless, despite all that, I still believe that Labour's local leaders have done right by their constituents in embracing the chance to reshape the Tory state orthodoxy. As Mike Emmerich of Metro Dynamics and this city has argued, there are reasons to believe that the economy of the North is being harmed by cuts in public spending, and that austerity, far from delivering reductions in public spending, is generating additional and unaffordable social costs. But the process, he continues, of building a northern powerhouse, of growing the northern cities together to stimulate the economy, is without doubt one policy that makes economic sense. So I think there should be pride rather than shame in Labour leaders seeking to get the best out of these deals. After all, our constitution commits us squarely and unashamedly to that duty to represent our communities. So health services run in Manchester by this local Labour leadership will in my view be a lot more progressive than those still tied to the Conservative Party in Westminster. And this ultimately is the rub about the Devo deals and so-called Northern powerhouse. Barring a political disaster next month, many of the relevant areas will democratically belong to the Labour Party, which offers us a tremendous platform to demonstrate the value of progressive Labour government to the country, to show how we can tackle inequality, how we can strengthen the common good, how we can hand back power. And we're already seeing it in action across the country. Oldham Council's youth guarantee, making sure every 18-year-old in the council has a place in either education or training. Leeds Council taking advantage of right to buy legislation to buy back cancelled homes and dramatically increase the city's affordable housing stock. Or the Coventry Investment Fund, a £50 million council bank initiative to help grow the city's entrepreneurs and small businesses. All Labour councils actively transforming England and its politics from the bottom up, laying the foundations for Labour ballot box success, I hope, in just a few weeks' time. But in Westminster, we cannot simply sit back and leave this work to our local government leaders. The challenge for us in Parliament is to learn from these civic leaders and then craft a localist vision which delivers the fundamental purpose of the Labour Party. And I think there are three key areas that we need to focus on in policy terms. The first is economic democracy. Financial power in this country remains massively centralised. For every pound taxed locally, only 9 pence comes back from the Treasury. And only 5% of taxpayers' money here is retained by local government. In Sweden, it is more than a third. In France, around half. Whilst in Canada, it is a staggering 80%. And the story of local government in the last 150 years, that total transformation in fiscal civic autonomy to the central state. The Tories have promised to devolve business rates, and we wait to see how this can be squared with redistribution. But I remain confident business rates can be devolved, that the incentive structure of local government can be improved without needlessly tearing up this country's social democratic fabric. After all, high levels of fiscal retention don't seem to particularly harm redistributive social justice in Sweden. Centralism, in my view, has not done enough to tackle inequality. After all, when the only fiscal vehicles left to councils are car parking charges and planning commission fees, it massively inhibits capacity for innovation, democracy, and growth. So we should look at local retention of more taxes, and why not give local government the powers to introduce tourist levies and hotel taxes? In Tokyo, they even levy something called an establishment tax, which could be regarded as the Owen Jones supplementary rent. But the lesson of urban history is that real political power always follows the money. If we want to reinvigorate local democracy, then we need to give local authorities much more fiscal autonomy. However, what we also need are broader fiscal institutions that can help decentralise access to start-up capital and investment. Centralised banks do not understand the intricacies of local economies at the best of times. But when it comes to local economic innovation, they understand even less. So now civic leaders, social entrepreneurs and wealth creators are coming together to create innovative new funds that boost local economic resilience. The Wessex Community Assets in Dorset, the Manchester Growth Company in this city, or the new council and LGA-backed municipal bonds agency. We should welcome and encourage that. But the next Labour government should also roll up its sleeves and begin the hard work of local institution building. What always struck me as a historian of Victoria and Manchester was just the multiplicity of finance during the great era of Victorian civic pride and the intimacy of finance, commerce and industry together. In Germany today, the sparks in the regional banking system still connects local savings with local businesses. It underpins both its extraordinarily equal spread of prosperity and a broader sense of shared responsibility between finance and industry. Now, after years of talking about it, go back to Will Hutton and Stapler, we actually need to start creating a system like that here. Every major city should have its own municipal bank, working hand in hand with a proper national investment strategy. Secondly, we need to focus on public service reform, because I believe this has been one of the great oversights of the Conservative approach to devolution. They remain far too in hoc to the 1980s corporatism of the Urban Development Corporation. So outside of this city and its unique health deal and now criminal justice deal, the opportunity for radical public service reform has been largely ignored. And this is a massive missed opportunity, because decentralisation offers the ability to deliver public services far more effectively than the central state. Its greater capacity to join up public services beyond departmental silos gives the local state a crucial innovative edge in tackling the complexities of modern social injustice. And let's face it, the traditional Whitehall model simply cannot cope with the burden of austerity. The NHS funding gap will be £22 billion a year by 2020. In social care, £3 billion a year. I do not believe the Labour Party can place itself in a position where its only answer to this challenge is simply to fight the cuts. This is also a question of delivery. Labour needs to back the ingenuity of the local state. Our devolution offer should go beyond economic resilience and give cities and councils the tools they need to fight for social justice. Without effective early years education, prenatal advances, maternal health and wellbeing support, then we are not giving every child an equal chance in success. And without an effective welfare to work programme, then the scars of long-term unemployment and economic equality will only deepen. Labour must go beyond the government's piecemeal approach, go beyond local authorities too, and look at policies such as community land trusts, which put power directly in the hands of people and communities themselves. As well as devolving powers to redesign services in welfare, health, social care, and arguably most importantly of all, schools and education, you cannot deliver economic resilience and social justice without good schooling. And as Sir Michael Wilshaw, Chief Inspector, recently said, without an improvement in education, the law of powerhouse would sputter and die. If the Labour Party had won the election, we would be devolving powers in schooling. And instead, the government has upped the ante on centralisation. In my view, you just cannot run 10,000 schools from the Education Funding Agency in Whitehall. On practical and ethical grounds, there has to be an element of local planning and democracy, of collaboration between schools for raising standards and spending money effectively. Every city should have a dedicated schools commission, appointed by and democratically accountable to the relevant city, combined, or local authority. And actually, the move towards mass standardisation makes this even more important, that actually you split the purchase and provide a model, and actually you can have a really effective model for schools commissions. So we need to rip down the ring fences, move towards long budget cycles, unconstrained by departmental bickering, scorch the silos. People's lives do not fit neatly inside them, and it's increasingly outdated to think our social justice ambitions ever could. There's another whole area of policy, which in truth Labour has also ignored. An area which I do not believe any truly common good approach to civic politics can avoid anymore. And that issue is ownership. And I believe it could become the cornerstone of our municipal socialist revival. All around the world, local governments are finding ways to take control of their energy, water and broadband supplies. In Germany, more than 100 contracts for energy distribution networks or service delivery have returned to the public sector since 2000. And you can see that beginning to happen here in the UK too. Whether directly supplied and owned by cities and councils, such as in Nottingham and Woking, or through cooperative community trusts, as in Bath or Brighton. Furthermore, in the same period, 235 towns and cities across the world have municipalised their water and sanitation services following public dissatisfaction with private providers. And with Berlin, Atlanta, Paris and Houston on the list, this is no leftist rogue gallery. In fact, in America in particular, this movement has often been driven by conservative Republican politicians. A recognition of the simple fact that civic ownership can lead not just to better public services, but also to a much simpler, more efficient use of taxpayers' money. Labour should draw on its own proud heritage of municipal socialism to reinvent England's towns and cities, usher in a new era of civic provision for our essential services. So I'm calling on the government to look specifically at how water services in England provided by local civic organisations as it implements legislation to increase competition in the water industry. Something that Ofwat should also consider as it conducts its review of retail household markets over the coming months. But we must also make sure that we're giving local leaders the support they need to compete in the changing energy and broadband markets, whether through better access to finance or reversing some recent damaging policy changes, such as the removal of social investment tax relief from community energy projects. In the 1940s, municipal ownership of gas, water and electric utilities accounted for 80% of total provision nationwide, with receipts from these essential services providing 30% of local authorities' income. Reviving that ethos can boost economic resilience and provide cheaper, more efficient services. It is about putting real power into the powerhouse. Alexander, since the early 1800s, Manchester has been a city of the future. The reason why Friedrich Engels came here, Alexis de Tocqueville, even Otto von Bismarck, was to get a preview of the socio-economic changes coming their way. The reason why my great-grandfather, James Clerk Maxwell Garnett, lived and worked in Manchester as principal of the College of Technology, was to be at the cutting edge of science and innovation. Before I entered politics, my professional life was as an urban historian, and the wonders of this original modern city was always its sense of autonomy, power, and purpose. Today we're gathered in a museum dedicated to the past, but in a city once again dictating the future. Authority's approach to the new urban settlement must be to combine both. Unite our historic mission to battle inequality with the new tools of political devolution and economic democracy. For we stand on the cusp of a new generation of progressive leaders taking control of real power in cities like Manchester, Newcastle, and I hope Birmingham and Bristol to come. The insight of the modern era is that tackling inequality and building a fair economy is best done by local people and urban power. It is time to forge a Labour League of progressive cities determined to use new powers to grow their economies, educate their young people, build new housing, and renew their democracy. Labour Manchester is leading the way. And like those busy bees ingrained in the mosaic tiles of Manchester Town Hall, we in Westminster should help pollinate its success across the country. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you, Tristan. Fantastic, wide-ranging speech, and I'm going to open up to questions in a moment when there's a roving mic. Just to kick us off, you spoke about a number of subjects. One of them was economic democracy, and one of the kind of big conversations when you're talking about places raising more of their own money, keeping more of their own money, is winners and losers. And that's one of the big concerns. How do you let places keep their money while also redistributing? What's your thoughts on how you kind of deal with that winners and losers issue?
I think it's an incredibly tricky question, because on a sort of pure model of this, you know, Stoke-on-Trent loses and Kensington and Chelsea wins. And we don't want to see an exacerbation in some sense of existing inequality. But I think if we get caught up just on that, the other tools that we want to see in terms of challenging inequality, in terms of more fiscal autonomy, in terms of more income streams for local authorities get lost. And we almost hit this barrier to begin with. I think I also take the view that we see in many other countries across Europe a commitment to much greater fiscal autonomy with also a more effective approach to redistribution and tackling inequality. So we need to find a smart way through on this whilst having the incentives to promote growth locally, whilst also not making Stoke-on-Trent lose and Kensington Chelsea gain. But what I would say is, okay, the best kind of treasury minds are, as I'm working on this, if we have that as the immediate instant barrier to where we want to get, then some of the richer ways through on that will be lost. So I think my plea will be, we all know that blockage, but let's not let it sort of ruin the kind of creative thinking that we need to see.
Great, thank you. Can I open up for questions then? So if you could say who you are, where you're from, I'm going to take them in groups. So can I have one over there? So everyone might just come over there. I was wondering if you said that question. Thank you.
Thank you, Christian. I'm from England, so go softly with it, but I was born in Salford, so I'm okay. My mission in England is I'm a director of a community interest company, which is to do with sustainable development, and basically it's to do with regeneration. And part of my mission is to try and work out how we work with what I call the broken local government system we have, because having travelled around the message I get is that we do need this devolution of financial responsibility and devolution. I think we call it devolution of democratisation. So, my point is trying to make things happen in the leagues, and I speak as I see it, so I often upset people. The comparison. comparison between Leeds and St. Mark's, which is the city, it says it's the second city. And the people there who have got some devotion and responsibility, the Lord, as far as I can see, it has a gift from central government to the way it's grown. It's resulted in people running the civic authority who are not only sort of better equipped, but they're younger.
So, is that your kind of question?
My question is, how do we work, what we've got now for 4 or 5 years, as we're going to sort of carry on with this central thing, play loops at the time of motion? How can we try and introduce what I call pragmatic socialism in cities like Leeds, where they're worried about the mayor coming from Bradford and like, therefore not like decentralised?
Great question. I know that's a topic of considerable interest. Thank you. But just here, please. We've just got one mic, so bear with us while it races round. I'll get one more after this and then go back to Tristan.
Hi, thank you. My name's Peter, I'm from Oldham. 2 points very quickly. Tristan, you talked about fiscal devolution. You didn't mention what George Osborne said this morning about the EU referendum, that the UK economy is now 80% services. And I wondered if Manchester was formed as a huge industrial base, manufacturing, and I wondered if you felt that had any role to play in future cities. Second point very quickly, if you look at an electoral map of England, most of it is blue, and a lot of that is to do with rural areas. I wondered, is this focus on cities for Labour that you're proposing to the exclusion of the rural areas, or how do they fit in? Thank you.
Great, thank you. One more question, just there.
I am Jennifer Williams from Western News. Really straightforward question, really. I've got some from the Labour leadership that they perhaps don't quite get the agenda that's being pushed in Greater Manchester at the moment, but perhaps in terms of the Labour Party, perhaps they just hear a bit further ahead than some of them managed, perhaps even some of the membership's heart. I wonder whether we'd actually had any conversations with Jeremy Corbyn about this and whether it was something you think you'll come around to.
Some great questions there, Tristan. Over to you.
Thank you. On the financial devolution and in a sense, the stark contrast with our European urban equivalents, part of this, and Leeds is a very good example in a sense, is, and this is why I return to economic democracy time and again, is the importance of finance. In the very old days, we had multiple stock exchanges right across the country, here in Manchester, Newcastle, Liverpool, Leeds, elsewhere. And having an area of sort of having a financial ecology in a city builds and nurtures leadership and talent, which becomes this sort of self-sustaining process. Which grows and develops the city. And it was very worrying to see the report, I think, from Pricewaterhouse today about the loss of talent from many northern cities to London. I mean, as a historian, the people have been complaining about London stealing talent since the 1740s. It is a perennial part of our culture, but it goes in waves. And I think that the impact of globalisation in terms of making London so much more this sort of dark Death Star, sucking everything towards it, and the effect on the broader sort of English urban economy is really dramatic. But your point is also in a sense about parochialism. I represent Stoke-on-Trent. We were one of the first mayors under the last Labour government. We then had a referendum to get rid of the mayor, and actually we spent, to my great regret, we spent most of the 2000s, whilst other cities were filling their boots and rebuilding themselves, having a long and detailed argument about the nature of civic governance, which meant that we didn't gain from it. But the combined authority model necessitates, and here in Manchester you've had it, the subjugation of some of that parochialism to a broader end. And I'm generally in favour of that, because I think the commercial and financial industrial benefits for it outweigh the risks. Peter, your point about services. I mean, Oldham, of course,
great industrial centre. Actually, what's very interesting about the economic history of Manchester, Manchester was not, in many ways, an industrial city. It was a service and commerce city. It was the place where you did the deals. You know, the showy warehouses of Princes Street were about sort of, you know, display rather than, in a sense, production. But your broader point is, in a sense, about industry and cities. And I'm always sort of fascinated by Edward Glaser's work on the triumph of the city and his extraordinary account of how Boston used to be more industrial than Detroit. But Boston made a decision about diversifying its economic base, exactly what's happening in Manchester in the last two decades. And so having an effective service economy doesn't seem to be opposed to you know, what we're seeing in urban areas. And you know, it's actually a strength for Britain. I think this whole agenda is more complicated in rural areas, and we're seeing that, I think, with the attempt at the combined authority with Norfolk and Suffolk and Cambridgeshire, which is a real sort of hodgepodge. Now, if you're a cynic, you would say, well, this is exactly, we're seeing, as it were, too many Labour mayors, and this is an attempt to create a kind of Tory combined authority to have that kind of blue mayor vision. Whatever the truth of it is, the Labour Party, you're absolutely right, has to have a different story, but an equally compelling story for those areas, which isn't going to be necessarily the same kind of urban narrative. Joseph, finally, I think, as I said, I think Manchester is leading the way, and I don't think it is unhealthy that you have a divergence from the national leadership on some of these issues. The whole point about, you know, the notion that the mayor of Chicago would be concerned by what the Democratic National Committee thinks should be, you know, is absurd, or the mayor of Los Angeles should necessarily be fearful of what Hillary Clinton thinks. I mean, I think we have to, and you do it, you know, very well in Manchester, have to have that confidence about what the city needs and what and the political leadership it needs. But I haven't discussed all of these policy ideas with Jeremy Corbyn.
Thank you. Another round of questions. So just one here and then a couple over there, please.
I'm Tristan. Nigel Barlow, I'm editor of the local Manchester News website. I totally agree with you, everything you said about the concept of local autonomy and better decision making. However, there's one thing you didn't allude to, it's a problem that we have in Manchester, and that's democratic accountability. The very low turnouts in local elections, the fact that we are to use the president of a one party state, and the fact that we have an elected chief executive who runs across as much as the prime minister.
Okay, thank you. And there's a couple in the middle there. Ed.
HS2. Crossrail and all the other infrastructure that goes into London. We get extraordinarily small percentages in the rest of the country. I mean, surely that has to stop, and we can't have a stock exchange over here because of high frequency trading.
Thank you.
Just put it here.
Thank you. You want to sit down?
I just remember that from what I just said. Recently, we've seen the idea of devolving and tax be put forward by because we're going to do like a network such as the policy network. Do you think a form of devolving and tax would help?
Thanks, and just one more on the computer, just to keep you busy. Exactly. Yeah.
Hi, Christian. Andy Michael, University of Manchester City. As a historian of empire, I'm thinking about the analogy of the Soviet Union. Mikhail Gorbachev, of course, was very keen to reform the Soviet state, and he wanted to reform it. The world wanted to reform too. Boris Yeltsin, of course, famously urged that the regions of locality should swallow as much sovereignty as they take. And in a way, I'm reminded of the way which they were approached and formed the United Kingdom of Africa. There was a clear idea about what was wrong about the British state, the devolution to Scotland and Wales. Didn't particularly have a clear path about what was devolving to. And in the same way, it would appear that there seems to be an urge, I thought it was very refreshing to hear what you had to say today, new clinic, a new ground, but there clearly seems to be an urge to encourage localities and regions to swallow as much sovereignty as they can take. Boris Yeltsin, within 4 years, had managed to turn the Russian state into a livable mess because they couldn't control it. And it would seem to be that the approach taken at the moment by both Labour and Conservatives doesn't seem to have a clear aim yet. And I wonder whether you could just clarify. Do you see England at the end of this as devolving in an asymmetrical or symmetrical way? Okay. And if so, how does that change that notion of English and British citizenship?
Great. So we've got democratic accountability, infrastructure, devolved income tax, and the Soviet Union. Off you go.
Well, that's one part of the stage. Nigel, the criticism, in a sense, of the combined authority and the lack of democracy surrounding it, the response to that is always that the democratically elected councillors agreed to it and took the decision. I think the criticism, I think a fair criticism is an absence of sometimes enough engagement and explanation about what the AGMA is, the consequence of AGMA, the move to combined authority, what it means. Even though it strikes me as a Labour in Parliament, you have incredibly responsive Labour councillors in this city who are out working very hard. There is a mystery around some of the combined authority which needs to be addressed. Now, that's not to say, if you only understood it, it would be fine. But I do think there's space for deeper understanding of what has taken place and your rights around it. And I think when you go to a slightly larger political unit, there's more space for direct engagement and democracy within it. So more popular forms of accountability surrounding that, I think would be helpful. I totally agree on the infrastructure point. The disparity is shocking. In Stoke-on-Trent, we just looked at the new, they've listed the new sort of National Civic Infrastructure Plan. We get absolutely nothing. There is no allocated funding to North Staffordshire for infrastructure projects. But don't worry, they're building a garden bridge in Chelsea. So that's okay. Ben, on the devolved income tax, I don't know the answer to that, but it is exactly the kind of thing that should be in the mix and being discussed. It is of interest that in Scotland these powers are not being used, there's an interesting conversation to be had about city deals in Scotland and the Scottish Government and how actually they don't really like them and aren't really sort of supporting them. But I think it should be. I think it should be in the mix. We should look at it. But I don't know the answer to it. And Andy, on where we sort of end. I agree. My starting point as a sort of somebody who looked at the history of this is absolutely for local authorities to grab as much power as possible, rather than waiting to be told what they can and can't do. Keep going until the judicial review is my view. Because that's, as it were, that's the history of innovative and successful councils is almost pushing the envelope to the endpoint. Now, where does it end? I think there are two routes. One is you answer the English question through a series of combined authorities and devolved local power, and that is, as it were, Manchester's economy is as big as Wales, and if you've got devolution there, you've got devolution in Manchester, and that is the answer to the English question. Or my view
is that we need a referendum on an English Parliament and have greater clarity about a federal UK. So I think you're absolutely right to ask the question about where it ends. I think there are two pathways, and either it's English Parliament or it's a richer and deeper form of devolution on combined authority and sort of deeper city deal template.
Thanks. I think we've got time for a brief couple of questions. So just lady in the middle there, and just at the front there.
Thank you. My name is Peter, and I'm from Sheffield. Although I think my father was probably the college that your grandfather was the principal of, so we love that. And I was probably in Denton, in Texas. The question I want to ask you about is democracy, because I'm increasingly worried that people are talking about entrepreneurial innovation, money, economics, and when I say, well, where do people fit into that? And people keep getting told, well, the democracy will catch up with it. And I'm deeply, deeply suspicious of that. These Devo deals are not the brilliant deals that people keep telling us they are. They are full of government requirements about how you can spend the money, guidelines, having to consult, etc., etc. And they've only been accepted, I know, in Sheffield City Region, because there was a bit of money attached to it, tiny amount of money, 30 million a year over a number of authorities, compared to the 300 million that Sheffield City itself has lost. So over the last 5 years. So
your question to Christian is, because I mean there's a lot.
Where are the people all of this? Where are the people? How do we catch up? How do we make sure that things are not being imposed centrally? Because that's what's happening. We've got goods of the heads, and we're not getting good deals with the people.
Great question. And then there's one moment that lady just at the front.
Thank you for that. My name is Beth. I'm an assistant councillor in Manchester. I was going to ask a question about democratic devolution, or is it something that I haven't heard about, but I'll slightly tweak it. So you spoke a little bit about redistributing social justice, and beyond sounding like a socialist background, which I quite like to sound of. I wondered if you could expand on how you think that might work. So we have a quite disgusting increase in homelessness. And do you mean that it would be easier or be more potential for us to look at areas that citizens are demanding we look at and then bring them into that service design, access those services are involved in it, or do you mean it's easier for us all to get a slice of it and we're not quite sure what it takes?
Great final questions, all about people, really.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, Vicky, I think you exactly laid out the labour critique of what's taking place, and a lot of the way in which these city deals are done are secretive and very unclear. I think actually at the University of Sheffield, Matthew Flanders and others are doing really good work on the citizen input into the city deal model. And so that's why I call for both political devolution and economic democracy. It seems to me, if this is just the old urban development corporation model, it really doesn't take account of where we are, of how people want to be involved within this, and also its long-term resilience. So I think flexing one's democratic muscles as part of it is really important. Now, there's a balance because, Alexander is far better qualified to say than me. In Gateshead, Gateshead had pulled out of the North East deal because they didn't like it. Will that over the next 5, 10, 15 years hold them back relative to Manchester or Sheffield or Liverpool? And it is a real balance between, as it were, a sort of defence of all the existing democratic norms versus some of the kind of corporatist advances you get from the city deal. I think our challenge is to find a way through, but also it shouldn't be one size fits all. You know, actually, the history of Manchester is a more corporatist history. Manchester was a city of merchant princes and the leadership surrounding that. Radical Sheffield had a slightly different approach to these things. And so it seems to me you can have different, there should be room for slightly different approaches to this. But I think it's up to local people, obviously, you know, through council and all the rest of it, to make that clear. Beth, I mean, the vision in terms of, I think the social justice vision is you deciding as democratically elected councillors where best to spend your money, but also, and again, this is, I think, my criticism of the existing model, not being told, okay, well, here's the money, but you can only spend it on this, this, and this. You know the causes of, you know, some elements of homelessness, and whether that's around housing, whether it's about mental health, whether it's about family breakdown. But at the moment, too much of the devolution model means that income streams have to be spent on X, Y, and Z, rather than you thinking cohesively and coherently about how this pot is best spent. So my argument to you is that I would like to see greater autonomy and decision making by local leaders with funds delegated and devolved to them to address at root the problems. But in the long run, that will also be about economic growth in Manchester. And you know, this, again, the lesson from history is that political power and civic autonomy and financial and industrial muscle often go together.
Great. Thank you. So where next for this, briefly, because we're running out of time.
From a Labour perspective, we need to broaden and deepen this conversation and go to exactly the points about, you know, democracy, exactly the points about how the city deal agenda can take different forms, go to the rural point as well. I mean, I think there's a rich stream of work to be done from a Labour and Progressive stance on this whole agenda, which A, isn't going away, and B, in my view, shouldn't go away. There shouldn't be some sort of, you know, grudging response to it. We have to think about a Labour Party in the 2020s and how we want to shape this debate. So more and richer thinking on this, which I hope the Centre Cities will contribute to, in a charitable and non-partisan way.
Thank you very much. I was just about to say the same thing. Thank you. I mean, I think it's been a really rich debate, a gallop through history and into the future as well. And, you know, I've really enjoyed it. I think your message certainly resonates with a lot of our evidence-based, non-partisan, independent work, which is saying that we're not getting it right now. You know, that actually there is already a postcode lottery and there is already differences, so actually trying to find new ways of doing this, making the most of cities really matters. So some really powerful messages about the economy, public services, people, democracy, a lot for us to reflect on. We'll be continuing to do work on this, all freely available. In the meantime, thank you all very much for coming. I know I couldn't get to everybody's questions, so I'm sure there'll be time to debate afterwards, and I think this debate can, should, and will run and run. But in the meantime, I ask you all to thank Tristan very much for his speech.